Like, this is something Barry talks about a lot, is that if the problem we have now is downstream in some ways of very large, grandiose thinking that overestimated our own powers of control and ownership of the world, then we shouldn't necessarily expect to have grand theories to fix them, because the grand theories in some way are the problem.
Welcome to Communion and Shalom.
In this podcast, we are exploring how the biblical and historic Christian faith can engage sexuality, ethnicity, culture, and our local communities as we pursue the flourishing of God's kingdom. Our goal is to engage these topics charitably and with nuance.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Communion and Shalom. I am pleased to have with me Brendan Johnson, who's helped host before, and hey, our special guest, Jake Medor. Thanks, Jake, for joining.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm glad to be here.
A little bit of background about Jake, in case you don't know him. He's a fourth-generation Nebraskan, lifelong Lincolnite, studied at University of Nebraska-Lincoln with a BA in English and History, and wrote a thesis about Kwame Nkrumah. Did I say that right?
Nkrumah, yeah.
Okay. Who was a mid-20th century Ghanaian politician. So Jake's been writing about politics, culture, the way that Christian faith speaks to all the various questions that kind of living in this world raises. He's written a number of places online, but he's primarily the editor-in-chief of Mere Orthodoxy, written two books, and we'll be talking today about the first one, In Search of the Common Good. The second one is What Are Christians For? Life Together at the End of the World. And you enjoy living life in Lincoln, enjoy following Premier League soccer, and spending time with your wife, Joy, and your four kids. Oh, another similarity, Jake and I are both members at PCA churches, so we have that shared connection. So, this first book, In Search of the Common Good, we are really interested in it because Brendan and I, particularly, as we've been thinking about local communities in this, we've been hitting on this theme of the commons, and it actually ties really well with a quote you have pretty early on by theologian Oliver O'Donovan. He says that healthy communities must be organized around what O'Donovan calls common objects of love. And you ask, do we have, you know, any of those common objects today in America? But as we think about local communities, sometimes we're just like, oh, it's the people who I spend time with. But what actually, you know, brings unity is those common objects of love. So we've been kind of hitting on that topic of the commons, especially historically, if you check out our previous podcast. And so your book, In Search of the Common Good, piqued our interest, and we were excited to hear more about it. Could you tell us what the impetus of the book was when you wrote it and what you hope it accomplishes?
Oh, man. Well, it's funny because the book's 5 years old now, so it kind of takes me back a little bit. yeah, so in the mid-2010s, there started to be more and more writing on, there were two different tracks that I saw. One track was various books dealing with a kind of emerging, and I think it's probably gotten sharper in the years since, conflict between a lot of Christian ideas about the good life and kind of broader conceptions of the good life you find in the West. And so that could be anything from Archbishop Chaput, who's Roman Catholic, I think just Archbishop. I don't think he was ever a cardinal. He wrote a book called Strangers in a Strange Land. Rod Dreher's book, Benedict Option, was probably the best-selling of this group. Rusty Reno had a book called Resurrecting the Idea of Christian Society. So there are all these books, mostly by Catholics, dealing with these kind of issues. But then at the same time, there were books dealing with breakdown of common life in the West. And so George Packer, who's a writer, was a writer at the time for The New Yorker, don't know if he still is, he had a story or a book called, I think it's The Unwinding. It's been like 6 or 7 years since I read it now. But he had a book on that. You had books about smaller scale kind of communal crisis within different subgroups within America. And I was looking at those things and felt that there's a connection here. Because if we have the idea that Christian moral teachings agree with the design of reality, that they are teachings that guide us toward health and flourishing, as those teachings are forgotten, not only by the broader culture, but even by the church in many cases, you should expect to see some conflicts emerging, and you should expect to see a crisis of common life coming out of that. And so the thought behind the book was to try and draw together the kind of Christianity versus culture crisis books of Dreher, Reno, Anthony Esselin had one like that, these different writers with the crisis of common life stories. Oh, who's the Bowling Alone guy? Putnam?
Yeah, Robert Putnam.
Yeah. Bowling Alone. That's kind of the text for that genre. So yeah, Putnam, Packer. There were a few others that I was drawing on as well while writing. But the thought behind the book was to try and draw those two threads together and then address them as kind of one problem instead of two separate ones.
Yeah, I appreciate that framing of it. When you mentioned the Bowling Alone book, I'm in training to be a psychiatrist. And one of the things in my field that we've been talking a lot about recently is this kind of crisis of loneliness. The U.S. Surgeon General actually just put out a report within the last year that was about this crisis of loneliness. You know, the U.K. has like a loneliness minister now, kind of famously. I'm not sure if it's working or not, but in this kind of more medical circles, or the more justice and medicine circles that I've been in, they seem to have a pretty different framing, I think, than the one that you have promoted in this book. And I wonder a little bit about this tension between almost like an idealist framing of what's going on, like we've lost a story, or we've lost an idea, or we've lost a culture, and that the kind of breakdown in our common life is downhill from that somehow, versus maybe more of like a materialist picture, like, you know, even thinking about the way that like China joining the World Trade Organization in 2000 and like the kind of decimation of American industry, or NAFTA causing kind of changes in agriculture and demographics across North America. Like these seem, in my mind, I'm curious, like these seem to be much more related to like the material causes of social breakdown. But I'm curious, is there a relationship between those two, or how do you kind of see that question?
Yeah, so actually it's funny, the second book that I did for IBP takes up the materialist side of things a lot more. So like in that second book, I have a discussion about breakdown of the household in the aftermath of the Industrial Revolution, which I'm pulling, Nancy Piercy's actually written about it considerable length. There's also a kind of leftist tech critic named Kirkpatrick Sale, whose work I draw on for that a lot. And his Sale's critique in particular is looking at the ways that the Industrial Revolution takes work out of the home, and and because of the way it disrupts the relationship to work, it actually disrupts a bunch of other things. But the only thing that was really addressed socially was, now instead of working in the home, you're working in the factory. But it's like, okay, so what are the knockdown effects for children? What are the knockdown effects for raising children in a home where, you know, it used to be you could go down to dad's workshop and watch him work and learn a trade from observing him. And now dad's gone. I mean, these days, 8 hours a day. Back in the early Industrial Revolution, it was quite a bit more than that. So I definitely try to take up some of that in the second book. The book I've actually been telling people to read, because I think it pulls on both of those threads really well, is Andrew Wilson's Remaking the World, which just came out last year from Crossway. Andrew's a pastor in the UK. I tease him that he's kind of an annoying person sometimes, because he's a full-time pastor with a PhD, I think, in New Testament, if I remember right, who kind of out of nowhere writes this remarkable history of the emergence of the 21st century West that gets raving blurbs from Mark Knoll, amongst other people. And it's like, one person shouldn't be able to just pivot like that at such a high level. But Andrew's book is very good on that. I'm deeply concerned with the material factors that drive a lot of these things. I'm a big Wendell Berry reader, so you get some of that materialist critique from Berry. The thing that is interesting, I was actually just reading something yesterday that made me think about this. So if you just take one particular social problem that is getting discussed more today than it did when I was writing the first book, declining birth rates, which really interesting with the data we have on that so far is that really, really aggressive, like pronatal policy from the state doesn't seem to move the needle that much. And we're even talking about, like, in Hungary, if you have four kids, you don't have to pay taxes the rest of your life. Like, very, very aggressive pronatal policies that you can find in some of these countries that don't seem to move the needle much. And the thing I was reading is by a Catholic woman who's got a book coming out. I'll have to try and find it again. And her argument was that it's not that we shouldn't have pronatal policies necessarily, because we should try to make it simpler for people to have children. And yet, if all you do is you create these material incentives to have children, that doesn't necessarily help with the fact that raising children is really, really, really hard. And so, not having to pay taxes is great. That doesn't mean that you get more sleep at night. It doesn't mean all of these different day-to-day things that are really hard about family life. The public policy stuff doesn't help without a ton. It can maybe reduce the noise a little bit by maybe removing some financial stress, things of that nature. And yet at bottom, you still need some kind of internal story that helps you recognize why you're doing what you're doing. It helps you see a broader picture than just like, this is the third time I'm getting up tonight and I'm exhausted. And I don't say all that to downplay the really beautiful, delightful parts of having a family, but there are things that are hard that are not solved purely through material policy or material aid. And so I think there's got to be a kind of give take here between both of those drivers. So it's something I think about a lot, because I go back and forth between, like, I thought Professor Truman's Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self book was very idea-driven in its analysis. And I think left some economic factors out. But then I can go find, not so much amongst Christian writers, but, like, I remember reading Terry Eagleton a number of years ago and reading his book on Marxism. And he was a little bit more alert to bad ways that materialist theories get applied to society. But I think we have to find ways of trying to synthesize both of those drivers, and probably having some very highly targeted forms of analysis that allow us to make careful distinctions between what's going on in this situation versus this very different situation down the road somewhere. Sorry, that's kind of rambly, but it's something I think about a lot, and I'm not totally satisfied with where I always end up on it.
How would you sum up, so on the material side, there's just so many factors, like for Hungary, was that Hungary you were saying about the declining birth rates, and they have this very proactive tax policy. What is the idea or the culture that is, you would say, is underlying this, their decline in birth rates? Speculating.
So, I mean, there's lots of really complicated scholarship on what causes declining birth rates. It's hard to get into it. One of the things that's odd about it is basically we're at a point now where even places like India, which was once soaring populations, their birth rate I think, is around replacement level right now, or maybe even a little below. The U.S. defied a lot of demographic trends for a long time, and now we've dropped down to more European levels. East Asia is like apocalyptically bad. If you look at China or South Korea,
below one.
And so there are going to be factors there around cost of living. These are the material factors, cost of living, housing. These are the things that I hear about, not so much in Lincoln, because our housing is still relatively affordable. But certainly when I talk to friends on the coasts in more expensive cities, you know, if you have a 2-bedroom apartment in New York, it's going to be pretty hard to make a large family work. The old Jim Gaffigan bit about how they have 5 kids and relax. We have a 2-bedroom apartment in Manhattan. We thought it through. So those are the material factors. I do think as well, there's a lot of, I mean, if you read coverage on things like dating and relationship formation right now, there is so much uncertainty and angst and anxiety that I think a lot of people bring into dating and family life that I think would have to show up as something that would affect your confidence to get married, your confidence to start having kids. There's also something about how do you value the weak and the vulnerable that I think is really important. If you decide that you're going to have, I mean, we have 4 kids, which by today's standards is a large family. It's not really that, like, historically speaking, that's average for much of American history. You are going to have to give up some of your own desires and pursuits. Oftentimes this falls especially hard on women who, just for being the one that give birth, are their body will be changed. They will be kind of in a weird position with their career for a long time, even after giving birth to the baby, because there'll be disruptions to what they're able to do. If you don't have a way of reminding yourself of why this is worth it, and a way of being able to see these things you're giving up as not being too high a cost because of all these things you're getting from being able to form a family and see these new lives emerge and hold that new baby in your hands and be the one who gets up with that child in the night. If you are able to recognize the worth and value of that sort of attentiveness to someone who is vulnerable and who is in need of you, I think that probably makes it easier to handle the trade-offs. But I don't know that we as a society have lots of scripts for valuing the at-risk and the vulnerable. I mean, you can just look at, look at what we do with our elderly. We put older folks in a home and we forget about them. You look at the way we often respond to the poor. There's a general, not everywhere, but in many places, a general disdain for the weak and the vulnerable who are not able to achieve and advance and accomplish things in the marketplace. And so I don't think it would be surprising then that a society that has disdain for other people who are weak and vulnerable would also struggle to value, like, perhaps some of the most vulnerable people we can imagine, a baby, a young child.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if the way that these kind of dovetail too, as I'm thinking about it, is it feels like there's this sense that there's less kind of margin that people have. Like, and maybe this is related to the breakdown in the common good. Like, it's not like the world feels maybe less safe. You know, there's fewer. Like, you really need to have so much more kind of personal resources, be that social resources, financial, whatever it is, to kind of like ensure the safety of your family and children. Whereas maybe in a culture that has more of a robust common good, you can, like, the trust extends a little bit further and you feel better because you know that you can receive resources in a time of need. It's not all on you. Maybe you have family or you have friends around. You're living a little closer. Your finances aren't quite so tight. So I wonder if that can maybe almost be a bridge into this broader question of the common good, and like, what would it look like almost in very concrete ways to rebuild that sense of common good in American life? Like, when you're writing, and then when you're kind of thinking even after having written the book, like, brass tacks, like, what does that look like? Like, what can we build towards?
I mean, two things that I think we try to do as a family, I don't know how successful we always are, but two things we try to do is we try to normalize just asking for and also offering help in ordinary, mm-hmm. practical ways on a day-to-day basis. Particularly like in a place like Nebraska, it's a very independent culture, very self-sufficient. And there's actually, I only had put this together in the past year. There are material factors here that I think influence this too, because I was rereading O Pioneers by Willa Cather, and I had never like kind of internalized what it meant that whereas like Wendell Berry's Kentucky, the average farm size is 100 acres. Out here in Nebraska, the average farm size was 640 acres at the time of the homestead. So it's so much bigger. So yeah, everyone is much more spread out. And then what happened within about two generations of the Homestead Act was a lot of people hadn't been able to make it, which, I mean, you understand, like, it's a 640 acre farm in the 1800s. Like, yeah.
It's hard.
But then what ends up happening is the farmers that are successful buy up the farms that mm-hmm. aren't. And then you get even less population, less density. And so you have to learn how to take care of things on your own because there aren't people around. So even now in Nebraska, I think it can be hard for people to want to ask for help because they feel like if I'm in a position of needing help, that in itself means I have failed someone. Which is silly. And it's so highly reductionistic. Like, I remember we had a few years ago, some friends, they were redoing their kitchen. Husband was a super DIY handyman, had his own contracting company for a little bit. So he was redoing the whole kitchen, and the husband and wife needed to go out and find some appliances. And they were, the wife was talking to my wife and was saying, we're going out, we're kind of dreading it because we're going to have three kids along with us as we try to shop for a refrigerator and an oven. And my wife just, she and I didn't talk about it. We just kind of have this understanding, I guess. She just said, well, why don't you drop the kids off with us and just go shop? And so they had three kids. They dropped them off. Their kids played with our kids. So it didn't really add anything to our plate. It was just, okay, now our kids have some other kids to play with. And it allowed them to be able to go shop for appliances. I think those kind of little things can be really helpful. And a lot of people, it just doesn't even occur to us to either ask for help with something like that or to offer help to someone in a situation like that. So that'd be one thing. And then I think the other is related to it, which is just having an assumption that your home is not just for you. And I feel like Joey and I both spent time at LaBrie, which is a Christian kind of residential study center ministry that's been running for about 70 years now. And the radical hospitality that you experience at LaBrie is probably uniquely formative for us because we both went there at a very pretty formative and vulnerable time for us. And so it affected us deeply. But you begin with that assumption that our home is not exclusively for us. And it just starts giving you eyes to see, like, it's not that big a deal to be able to have another family over for dinner or spontaneously, like, host. I mean, when my dad was in the ICU for about 3-4 weeks, 8 years ago, he had a traumatic brain injury. And we had several families from church that just opened their doors for us to drop our kids off there so that we could be at the hospital. It's not that hard to do those kind of things. But again, you have to kind of have the habit of thinking in those terms and also of actually doing these things. It can be a really small thing, but of actually doing these things to either ask for help so that other people feel comfortable asking you for help, or opening your home, or like, these are just the things we kind of have to, I think that's where you have to start. There's not, like, this is something Barry talks about a lot, is that if the problem we have now is downstream in some ways of very large, grandiose thinking that overestimated our own powers of control and ownership of the world, then we shouldn't necessarily expect to have grand theories to fix them, because the grand theories in some way are the problem. So you have to reach back a little bit and get smaller and get more local in a lot of cases. Not always. There's a place for big policy stuff. But a lot of the times you do need to kind of pull back a little bit and try to shrink your focus to areas where you do have a little bit more agency and control, so that you can then just see what God calls you to do and enables you to do, and how you're able to bless the people around you.
Your story about just the opening of your home and LaBrie's kind of exemplary model of that hospitality. In the book, you talk about solidarity, and it's interesting, you know, in thinking about commons, I'm often trying to think about what are tangible things that we actually have common ownership of. But in the Christian tradition, even the things that we might properly say are mine, like this is my house, it's not the sharing of it is a practice of solidarity, not as much generosity sometimes. I think I'm critical of, especially around money, there's this like, oh, you're so generous, you're generous with your time. And there's space for that. But there's a part of it where you're like, well, of course, like, this isn't even generosity. This is just like, of course your kids can come over, or like, the Lord has given me this thing that I, quote unquote, is mine, but all of it's the Lord's, all of it is for us. And it's just shifting my thinking, rather than like, oh, I've moved something that was mine to you, but towards, yeah, ideas of solidarity and a more open-handedness of control.
Yeah. Well, the Roman Church, especially in the last 50 to 100 years, has developed this idea of a doctrine of the universal destination of goods. And so the idea there is that everything that God has made in the world is for everyone. And so, and I kind of developed this in the first book. I hadn't read as much in that then as I have now. But one of the things you find when you look at church history is that for a lot of the major theologians, property rights, to take one example, are regarded in very different ways than we tend to think about them today. I mean, I have a quote from Calvin in the book about basically relativizing private property rights by saying, like, your right to own three houses is trumped by the poor person's right to have food and shelter. And so and you can find, like, the church fathers go real hard on this, where I can't remember which one of them it is. I want to say it's one of the Cappadocians.
Basil.
Basil has the sermon where he says, if you have two coats, you've stolen one from the poor. That's a conception of property that is very different from the way a lot of people imagine what it means to own something in our current context.
Have you?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Brendan.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, just with the intellectual history side, I mean, that notion of like absolute property right comes from John Locke and is only a couple hundred years old. And it's amazing to me sometimes that we just have like absolutized this right. And I mean, that's tied in with American history and the right to property, and like that this is kind of tied up in what it means to have a good life and to be like a property owning individual. And when you read Christian thinkers throughout the, you know, all of these different ages, I mean, they are they are not big on property rights. And like you're saying, like they, I mean, those quotes by Basil are incredible. He's, you know, if you have two coats and like you're saying, and your neighbor dies because they don't have a coat, like you've murdered them. I mean, that is, that strikes us like so rudely. And yet it, that would be transformative if we were preaching that, you know, like, can, I can't even imagine like what, how would our churches and our economic relationships change if we caught that vision. But it feels very distant, but also, yeah, just kind of a really provocative witness too.
Well, and something we were actually just at my church last night, we were talking about parts of the Sermon on the Mount where Christ presses hard on certain commands that could be read as this very discreet. Well, do not murder. Okay, well, I've never murdered. But when Jesus is talking about the law, he presses deeper and he's like, well, the point of that is not, okay, I tell you, do not murder. And you say, got it. I've never done that. I'm good. Like, that's not the thought there. Jesus presses deeper and says, have you ever hated anyone? Then you violated this command. Emil Brunner, he's a mid-century Reformed theologian, mid-20th century Reformed theologian. He talks about the inner infinity of God's law in his work on the Sermon on the Mount. And so there's an idea here where if you are reading scripture's moral teachings with the thought being like, okay, how do I define the limit, like where this teaching stops so that I know I'm in compliance with it? You've kind of already taken a wrong turn because no, the point of the law, it presses deeper and it convicts. And ultimately, it does give us guidance in the good life. It also reminds us of our need for Christ, and it humbles us so that we recognize our own need to repent, our own need for grace, and you kind of start all over again. But I do think it's very easy, perhaps especially in a society as legalistic as the U.S. is. You know, we really like our contracts. We like our very tightly defined policies and rules. And you kind of learn to relate to law as this thing that, like, okay, here's its confines, and as long as I don't transgress that, I'm good. And that's not, as the Sermon on the Mount makes very plain, that's not what God is after in God's eternal law.
Oliver O'Donovan has also been helpful for me in thinking about the relationship between rights and ethics, and that ultimately an ethical life is one that is fulfilling that the law of love. And that's where like liberty and fullness is found. And rights are just these, they're kind of like legal statutes for certain situations that can give you guidance on like, oh yeah, in this situation, don't work someone 80 hours a week. Like, that wouldn't be good. But that doesn't tell you a whole lot about
protection,
labor, and what an ethical workplace would be. Like, it's just this one small boundary to help you go in not the wrong direction.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and O'Donovan will make, I think it's, he'll laugh at this. A good friend of mine, Brad Littlejohn, is an O'Donovan student. And so sometimes I'll say O'Donovan said, and I'm actually thinking of something I heard Brad say. One of them, I think this was Brad, but he's probably getting it from O'Donovan, makes the distinction between right and rights. So right is the kind of ordering of the world as God has made it to function in a certain way in which we're authorized to act in certain ways for the good of neighbor. And rights are these kind of like itemized, delineated, almost like grocery store list of things that I somehow am able to like oblige my neighbors to give me. And the fundamental difference in how you imagine the moral life, just from that one letter, right versus rights, is astonishing.
In some of this kind of radical reorientation, moving from what are my personal rights, my property rights, into what is God's purpose for all this stuff in our life. I guess you mentioned the asking for help as a practice that you do in your family. Are there other ways that you've sought practices or local institutions that help people start thinking differently, start acting differently?
I mean, I feel like so much of it is just stuff that has to be caught more than taught, almost. That's something Charlotte Mason, who's an educator that my wife and I like a lot, she talks a lot about how education is an atmosphere. Students catch much more than they... A lot of what a student gets from school is what they have caught rather than what they've been taught. Mm-hmm. I think when it comes to these kind of things, so much of it really is atmosphere driven. You are in communities where you observe certain kinds of behaviors and practices, and that expands your own mind for what's possible. Because, like, we have some dear friends that are in Northwest Iowa. I've written about their home before. And it's so funny that, so he's a pastor in small town, rural Iowa. I have no idea what he makes, but it's a small church in rural Iowa. You can imagine. His wife has a administrative job at a small college nearby, and their house is probably 1200 square feet, if I had to guess. And yet they have been so creative and generous in how they've used their space. And so, like, the husband is a bit of a handyman, and so they actually, using mostly just reclaimed supplies, they've been able to build a couple little cabins on the property. They redid the old well house because it's an acreage. I think it's like 10 acres, so it's not huge, that he uses for his study. But then he also built a loft bed in there above his desk that he and his wife have sometimes used for extended periods of time because they're hosting other people in their home. And so it's the sort of thing where it's like, I don't know that there's a lot of, like, programs you implement or curriculums you go through necessarily. It's more that there's just an assumption of hospitality and generosity, and that that kind of becomes the atmosphere of a community. And when that's the atmosphere, people just kind of organically over time start recognizing, like, oh, we could do that. Like, I mean, that's something my wife and I have even thought about before. Like, they have these friends of ours, they'll often have a pretty large Sunday lunch at their house with people from either people from church or sometimes just people from the community, because they have there's a pretty good sized immigrant population in the town they live in, and they have folks from the immigrant community over a lot as well. It sounds like a lot for a pastor's family to have a huge lunch Sunday afternoon right after church, but they just will make some kind of big stew in a crock pot or something and leave it on the counter, and they go to church, and when they get home, it's all ready. And it's not that much more work to make the stew for 10 or 12 instead of 5 or 6. And then it becomes a very easy thing after church. You're talking to a visitor to say, well, hey, we're having lunch at our house in 20 minutes. Why don't you come? But a lot of it, I really do think it's just stuff that is kind of picked up over time as you experience hospitality and you're around other people that practice it.
Mm-hmm. Taking a shift towards some of the other themes in your book and in other writings of yours, you've really emphasized roots. You have a quote from Walter Brueggemann where he says, "There are no meanings apart from roots." Can you share with us what you mean by roots and how that connects to a Christian understanding of nature and redemption?
That's all.
You know, just the whole gospel story.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so, like, I can just talk about kind of how this has shaped me. I live in the town I was born in, Lincoln, Nebraska. I spent 1 year in the Twin Cities right after college trying to figure out what I was going to do next. And Wendell Berry was getting to me and ended up coming back home. My family's been in Lincoln since 1946. My mom's lived in the same neighborhood almost her entire life. It's about 15 minutes from me. And it's even been interesting to me lately. So the church that my parents go to is a little neighborhood church in Havelock, part of town it's called. And they just opened up a coffee shop for the neighborhood. It's this old railroad town, working class railroad town that got annexed by Lincoln in the 40s. Very independent, rough and tumble kind of place. So when Lincoln annexed them, they didn't want to get annexed. So they actually, to protest, they hauled out all of the city's records from town hall and had a big bonfire on Havelock Avenue, which made a point, except now there were no records for any of the houses in Havelock. And so like 55 years later, when my parents were trying, they were building a fence and they needed to know where the property line was. And they went to the city and the city was like, we have no record of your property. And my dad was like, how is that possible? And they're like, well, funny story. And so they had to pay a surveyor. So I'm like, nice job, 1940s Havelock. 2000s Havelock is now having to pay surveyors to figure out their property lines. It's a real little stunt. But so it's traditionally been this pretty thick, robust little town. My mom has tons of stories about just growing up and what that was. I mean, for her, like everybody on the street, their dads were all working at the railroad. So they all would leave for work around the same time. They'd get home around the same time. That's a lot of that's fallen apart in the decades since. And so the church was kind of looking around and being like, there's not really an easy place for people to just go congregate together, just to have conversation in Havelock. And we have a lot of people in Havelock that may or may not have a car. And so if you can't walk somewhere, you just might not have that. And so they opened up this coffee shop and I've been working there more during the day. And even just as I walk these streets in Havelock, there's a very strong sense of belonging that I feel there just because I walked those streets as a kid or we drove down them. Like I will go past the elementary school that I went to sometimes. So there's just a sense of familiarity and belonging that I think I feel, not just in Lincoln, but specifically in Havelock. And I think that sense of rootedness, it has a way of helping you know who you are. And this is, of course, a very kind of widespread problem, sadly, right now. It's just this sense of people not having a clear sense of who they are or what they want their life to be or what the good life is. And you kind of have to make those things up for yourself. And at its most extreme form, you'll get something like the Casey ruling that I talk about in the book, where Justice Kennedy says that central to the idea of liberty is the right to define your own concept of meaning and existence and so on. That's actually really hard to do. It's almost cruel, I think, to demand that of people sometimes. And so for me, the part of what roots allow us to have is a sense of where I come from and who I am, that I'm not having to just make up or that I'm not having to choose in the way that I would like choose which salad dressing to buy at the grocery store. But there's just a sense of these are things that were given to me just by virtue of where I was born, who I was born to, when I was born, and I can receive those things and they're part of me. And I never had to choose them. And I mean, I think about this sometimes to go back to the having children conversation. It's very helpful to me to know stories in my family and also just have the experiences I did of being loved by my parents. Because I can now place myself in that story and recognize, okay, at one point I was just like this child and my parents responded to me in this way. And now I'm kind of carrying that on another generation. So I think rootedness is a way of not having to just invent everything about who you are through pure choice. It's a way of being able to receive certain parts of your identity without having to choose them.
Picking up briefly on just the kind of identity in it in modern, especially in evangelical or Protestant circles, there's like your identity is in Christ. And, you know, all you need to find out who you are is to know God. And I've wrestled with ways that these true things, you know, this like the big meta narrative, the big gospel truths can seem to, you know, get in the way of what you're talking about. And I feel like they shouldn't be against each other, but practically they have been. Or maybe the theological things have been unknowingly greasing the wheels for the other forces that kill our roots that we've been talking about.
I mean, in some ways, it's a similar sort of thing as what we were talking about with property rights and how Calvin talks about those. Like, the point is not that there's no such thing as property rights or private property, or that you don't have some claim of ownership over property that is yours. Like, if somebody showed up and wanted to just start smashing up our house, I could protest and say, like, no, this is our house, not yours. You need to leave. And that's valid. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not me being selfish or something. Like, that's a real thing. But the point is that individual rights exist in relationship to each other. And so I think there's something similar here, is that there's a particularity that every human being has just as part of their own existence, of being born in certain places or to certain families, that is good. There is also a very universalist impulse in Christianity that is going to relativize that at certain points. And it's going to warn you against making an idol of that in the way that you mm-hmm. think about it. Like, this is something that I think Rod Dreher reckoned with in his move back to Louisiana, where he kind of, this is just the way he's talked about it, is that he had kind of made an idol out of his home and family. And he returned home and realized how so much of that was built on things that weren't true. And it was devastating. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he's talked about how in his writings, he said that the real religion of the South is ancestor worship. I don't know mm-hmm. it's entirely fair, but I get where he's coming from. And so there's a sense in which we need to be able to, like, recognize things as good, but as limited goods, and as something that can be qualified or relativized in ways by higher goods.
I really appreciated Dreher's blog post about, like, the challenges of returning home. And mm-hmm. I guess I've got a question that's maybe a difficult or a sensitive one, but I think it's important to ask. The last time I was in Lincoln, I was visiting a friend there, and she has indigenous roots in the area, and like grew up around Lincoln. And when we were there, we went out to kind of this park that was outside of Lincoln, and we were talking about some of the, you know, local indigenous communities, as well as the, I think maybe the Park Service has been introducing bison like back into the landscape. Mm-hmm. And right next to this park where we were talking about this was this Benedictine monastery. Mm. And I was just really struck, you know, even like reading your book, I'm from the Midwest, I'm from Minnesota. I think our families have had very similar kind of like stories of ethnic migration, like white Americans or now white Americans to the US and the Midwest. And it's like, that's only true for like a couple generations in your and my case. And like the sense of received identity, I find very beautiful and very compelling, but that's also like not very deep, just a couple generations deep. And the deeper story even than that is one of like genocide. Like, we killed the people and took the land. And when I say we, I mean Americans, and I mean white people, and I mean Christians. And so like, how does this sense of like received identity and rootedness and place-based belonging, like, how do we take the good of that while also not hiding the like deep violence and even violence that was even done in the name of Christianity, as well as, you know, Americanism and all that, manifest destiny? Like, how do we tell that deeper story? And then I'm also left, you know, asking again the material question of land, of like, there's this monastery here, and then there's this park, and there's this whole like land back movement in the indigenous world right now, trying to say like, let's get this land back to the original stewards of it, who have had this place-based knowledge and have had a longer, you know, sense for like who's on the land, what's good for the land. How do we like square all of that together?
So there's a lot of layers to that, I think. I think about this a lot. I try to understand as many aspects of it as I can. I would say I'm still very much thinking and reading a lot to try and get a handle on it. I think reckoning with the complexities of a lot of these stories can be very helpful. And complexities meaning we need to be willing to get into individual specific cases. Like one of the things that's odd for my family's history. So my entire family came over Ellis Island generation. None of my family was here before like 1882. And I think the last arrived in like 1905. So 6 out of 8 great grandparents for me came to Nebraska or Iowa. But they were all tenant farmers. They weren't actually homesteaders. They were the folks that were farming the land that the rich farmers who had done well out of the Homestead Act.
And bought up all their neighbors. Yep.
And then the other two were actually Greeks, and they were in Boston, which is its own kind of weird thing. Because like one of the stories that I've heard a couple times in the family is that so my Swedish grandfather, second gen Swedish immigrant farmer from grew up on a farm in Northeast Nebraska, married a second gen Greek immigrant from Boston. And then my great grandfather moved out here a little while after my grandmother and grandfather got married, because my grandmother was his only living family. And so he was this Greek man in Lincoln whose daughter was here, married into a Swedish family. And one of my granduncles apparently called my great grandfather remember if it was a dirty pagan or a pagan. One time, my great grandfather was a cantor in a Greek Orthodox church. But Greek did not always code as white in America. The Mediterranean peoples have a very different relationship to whiteness, as it would be understood in the U.S. than Northern Europeans. So there's all kinds of layers of complexity here. I do think something I've been thankful for just in my own family. So my grandfather had stories that the town that they were in is traditionally it had been the land of the Omaha Nation, in Northeast Nebraska, not too far from where the Rez is today, actually. And when my grandfather was growing up, it was still early enough that they had Omaha living nearby, and they would sometimes come to their house. And my grandfather said his great grandmother would always have like their door was always open to whoever came. And so my grandfather grew up sharing meals with members of the Omaha Nation in his home. And it wasn't because my great grandparents were doing great. They were migrant farmers from Sweden who had come over here. I don't know the reasons they came, but most of that Ellis Island generation that came over were pretty desperately poor themselves when they left. And in my family's case as well, my great grandfather today would probably have been diagnosed as bipolar. And so there was a heavier load on my great grandmother just because of my great grandfather's mental health. And yet they always made a point of having an open table for anyone that came to their house. And so it's something that I hope it's that I think about it in ways that are good. But again, talking about that received identity, part of that received identity in our family is that we actually have tried to be attentive to those racial dynamics in American life and those questions of justice. We've tried to do what we can in the small ways we can, again, being predominantly working class and recent immigrants ourselves. So it's complicated. I do think this is one of the places where the universalizing impulse in Christianity becomes very important. And it's one of the things, particularly in the time since I wrote that first book, there has been a move in some circles to so emphasize the goodness of particularity and rootedness that I mean, you get the most extreme forms of it in something like Wolf's Case for Christian Nationalism, where Wolf will even go on to say things like churches should generally be monocultural because our natural culture and belonging is so central. And so I think we need ways of recognizing how God calls us out of particularity toward neighbor. And sometimes that's going to be really complicated. Something I do try to develop a little bit in the second book is also the ways that race as a construct really drives a lot of this. So I talked like my grandfather, great-grandfather, who was Greek, was received very differently in the U.S. than my Swedish great-grandfather, where Swedes were kind of always in to some degree. I mean, they didn't have the wealth or cultural kind of status that Anglos did, but they were more like they were kind of always white, quote unquote, whereas for Greeks, it was different. They were often perceived as outsiders. They were perceived as a threat to the American order, not to the same degree as like Italian Catholics, but there also just weren't as many of the Greeks. So that could have been why. But there's something deeply distressing, but also important when you dig into the history of how race gets conceptualized and defined. That needs to be understood. I use some of Willie Jennings's work in my second book to try and pull some of that apart. But yeah, so it's very complicated. I mean, another thing that's striking with Nebraska, this part of the country especially, is that prior to the Homestead Act and white folks coming into the country, a lot of the history was like you had these more woodland nations like the Omaha along the eastern edge of the region. And then you had the Sioux on the west that were constantly at war with each other. Fairly one-sided wars for the most part. So, I mean, even when you reach back into history to try and define some of these like pre-Homestead Act national boundaries, it gets very complicated very quickly because you start to having to ask, well, okay, what national boundaries when, what's a valid way of changing boundaries. And so, yeah, there's just so many layers to it. It's been, I've tried to do more reading in, Native American history over the last couple of years. So that wouldn't have been something that would show up in the first book, but it's something I've been reading more about.
I loved, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's Indigenous History of the United States. That was really transformative for me, like, and especially the Midwest section, just because that's where I'm from, was really interesting. But it strikes me too that I appreciate the kind of multi-level and multi-layered approach to even starting to answer a question like this. And it strikes me that like particularity isn't always the answer, but it's like a great place to start the question. And like by asking, you know, who am I? What kind of people do I come from? Where do I live? What is this place? What is this time that I find myself in? Like, that's a great wedge to like open up a whole bunch of important questions.
My great grandparents have similar timelines for coming into the U.S. Most of my great grandparents were born in Russia and then came to Canada, actually, when they were children. And so my roots in North America are relatively short, and then I was the first person in my family born in Arizona, I think, and growing up in a place where none of my family have roots, and in Phoenix, a very new city relatively in terms of its rapid expansion, tons of people migrating there, concrete over everything. And Brendan, I think have you read the book Braiding Sweetgrass?
Oh, yes. Great, great, great one. Published in Minneapolis.
It has this concept around, I think it's naturalizing oneself. Like, if I'm to put down, there's part of the roots of my own heritage, but I thought if I were to, I'm in Minnesota now, but if I were to say, hey, you know, I was the first one born in Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm going to plant myself here, that I should seek to do so in a way that connects my roots with the roots of the land that's already there and the history that's already there, Whereas what I feel like I see most of the time is people trying to, you know, reproduce their, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know, Northeast American golf course greens in the middle of a desert because, like, that's what I, you know, like, want my world to, and they just terraform it rather than naturalizing themselves. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's more to.
That's nice.
I mean, this is something that Barry talks a lot about, is just the role of attention in caring for a place and understanding a place. And I think it's become, I mean, you can get tons of books and all kinds of scholarship now just on the difficulty of attending to things in the kind of technological environment we've created. One aspect of that, I think, is that we get worse at being able to attend to our local place. And we're getting worse at it because we're hooked to devices that are broadcasting very specific visions of the good life, syndicated out from media companies and other large businesses. And so we get handed these ideas of what is good or right or comfortable or desirable, that are quite explicitly disconnected from any understanding of climate or place or landscape. In Jaber Crow, Barry has a really just practical illustration of this where he talks about one of kind of the heroes of Barry's fictional universe is this farmer named Athy Keith. And Athy has this hillside farm in rural Kentucky. And farming on a hillside is complicated, but Athy's family's been on the land for a long time. He's a good farmer. He has limits on himself. And he doesn't ask for more than the land can give. And then his farm passes to his son-in-law, Troy, who doesn't really care that it's a hillside farm, doesn't really care that it needs trees in certain places to be healthy. He just looks at the land and says, whatever it can give, I want. That's a very different relationship to a place than what Athy had. So I always think of Jaber Crow in these kind of conversations and the way that Barry portrays Athy's relationship to the same piece of land and Troy's relationship to that piece of land and just the rival attitudes they have about it. There's a line at one point, I think he's describing them putting in a highway in near Port William in the 50s in Kentucky. And there's a worker that Barry describes as trying to get a chainsaw to work to cut down a tree. And the chain has come off and the worker looks at it and is disgusted and he throws it over his shoulder and it gets run over by one of the bigger, heavier pieces of equipment. And the last line is something like, no one in Port William had ever imagined such a thing before. Just the like utter indifference to the place, the tool that you have, such that like a totally fixable problem goes wrong and you just get rid of it. And it's fine because the thing coming in behind you is going to plow over it anyway. And it's just going to be part of the highway. There's just kind of a disposable attitude there that is itself really corrosive of a lot of important things. I think Pope Francis talks about, I think it's a throwaway society is the line that he uses. And I think there's a lot of, if you can kind of bring together John Paul's concept of the culture of death and Francis's throwaway society, there's a ton of analytical power just in those two frameworks.
We should probably get towards wrapping up. Brendan, did you have a question about thesis from the Ghanaian author?
Yeah, I was just really, I love the fact that you did your thesis on Kwame Nkrumah. And I'm curious, like, what about his life or his, you know, witness or his project, like, caught your imagination at that age? And tell us about that.
Well, so Nkrumah is fascinating because Ghana's the first independent nation in post-colonial sub-Saharan Africa. They become independent in 1957. And Nkrumah himself spends 15 years living in the West before he goes back to Ghana. So he's in the UK for 5 years, then he's in the US for 5 years, studying at Lincoln College in central Pennsylvania, historically Black Christian or Black college in central Pennsylvania. And then he goes back to the UK and he works as a political organizer there. And he's just a super, has a tremendously strong, just sheer force of will, charisma. So he actually, this kind of tells it all. He's been working as a political organizer in the UK with the diaspora from Africa, mostly from the Caribbean and then from Western or from sub-Saharan Africa in the UK with a guy named George Padmore. And he was kind of Padmore's secretary. And so as Ghana was heading, was in the Gold Coast, was heading toward independence, the plan was that there were all of these kind of like, there's an emerging like capitalist class of property owners, mostly in mining and timber along the coast around Accra. And these leaders were going to be the leaders of the new Gold Coast. And so they're very kind of bourgeois capitalist sensibility, very friendly to Britain and America. And this is what we're going to do. But they were all businessmen. They weren't politicians. So they needed somebody to come in and just help organize their political movement. And somehow they got Nkrumah's name. And so Nkrumah shows up to be their secretary. But then Nkrumah gets there. And Nkrumah had, and it's a little tricky. So when you talk about socialism in the post-colonial African context, it's very seldom going to be the same kind of thing as what you'd get in the Soviet system. So like Julius Nyerere is a Tanzanian Catholic socialist who actually has an entire discussion in one of his books on how he sees African socialism as being contrary to Marxian socialism. Because Marx socialism is built on class analysis and they didn't have class in pre-colonial Africa. And so you can't build your analysis around primordial conflict between the classes because that doesn't apply there. So Nkrumah is much more in that school than he would be the kind of European socialist movement. But it still does put him at odds with the business owners he's now working for. And basically, over 2 years, Nkrumah creates his own political party, shaves off almost all of the support of the business class party, and becomes the like star political figure in Ghana, which I think to be able to do that in that short a time from that position is just indicative of a really remarkably gifted, at the very least, individual. And so he was leading Ghana into independence, and his goal was that they would be non-aligned. They wouldn't be part of the Soviet bloc. They also wouldn't be part of the Western bloc. He, along with many of the African revolutionaries, felt that being aligned with either of those would just reestablish a new form of colonialism. So Nkrumah has a book called Neo-Colonialism, where he basically says, look, if we get into economic blocs with the West, we're just going to have economic colonialism and it won't really be that much better than what we had before. And yeah, so I was just fascinated by this project. I was really intrigued by people during the Cold War era that were trying to stay out of that conflict. Not because they were indifferent as to what was going on in either place, but like in Nkrumah's case, it's just, we're trying to establish an independent nation. Another really interesting part of Nkrumah's project is he's a big proponent of what's called Pan-Africanism, which is the idea of unifying as much of the sub-Saharan Africa and even getting into Northern Africa as possible, kind of in an EU-style relationship was Nkrumah's dream, because he felt that would create a large enough economic bloc that they would be secure and stable and not need the West or the Soviet. But of course, as he's doing all of this, there's enormous conflicts with the West and with the Soviets, because Ghana has all sorts of natural resources that both of those powers want. And so You get the kind of personal life of Nkrumah. You get the political intrigue in Ghana. You get the global foreign policy stuff. There's just a ton there. And it was super fun to do, just to learn about. There were even things like some of Nkrumah's cabinet was in the U.S. in the late 1950s. And they were on a speaking tour and also a diplomatic visit to the U.S. And they were driving through Delaware and asked to stop at a Howard Johnson's to get breakfast before they continued on to the next college they were speaking at. They were speaking at a bunch of HBCUs. And the diner in Delaware wouldn't seat them. And so this official from Ghana, like, wires home, tells them what's happened. The next day, like, the whole world knows that this, like, bastion of liberal democracy refused to seat the African government representatives at their restaurant. And it created such a crisis in the U.S. that actually President Eisenhower reached out to this guy to invite him to the White House. So you can, there's a picture of this. I think he was the finance minister in Nkrumah's government at the White House with Eisenhower and Nixon, because they had to go into damage control mode to try and patch this up. Because that, there's a whole book, it's called The Cold War and the Color Line, about how the Soviets basically weaponized U.S. Segregation and Jim Crow in their foreign relationships with post-colonial Africa. But then, of course, the knockdown of that was that Nkrumah could be extremely vain, and he was really upset because Nixon or Eisenhower hadn't come to Nkrumah's inauguration at Ghana's independence. He had just sent Nixon. There's actually even some evidence that Nixon at the hotel he was staying at in Accra was trying to tap some of the phones of other government officials in the hotel. He's on brand. See, like, there's just so much
hotels
here.
And wiretaping equipment.
He brought, and when he came, he welcomed or he met Nkrumah and he gave him a copy of the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence as his, like, how to start nation manual. But Nkrumah had not got to meet the president, and now his government official had. So he ended up, once they got back, his relationship with those officials, who were his most competent people by far, soured very, very quickly. And he kind of ended up, or he accused some of them of corruption, which may or may not have been true. And some left the country. One was imprisoned. And things just kind of slowly fell apart over the next few years until the U.S. helped back a coup to install a military government to replace him that would be friendlier to the U.S. But there's just so much just in his story. There's so many little details. Like, I remember coming across in one of the books I was reading a reference to, after JFK was killed, Nkrumah sent a letter to Jackie because he loved JFK and just felt so distraught at. So he said, there's this account of him sitting down at his desk and writing this kind of tearful letter to Jackie Kennedy, expressing his condolences on her loss. So yeah, there's just he's such a fascinating figure, very larger than life. His story gets caught up in all these other different things. I spent a year working on him. I wrote a 100-page thesis as an undergrad because I had a maniac for a prof who I'm so grateful to for making me do that. As much as I sat in his office when it was starting. I was like, so how long does this need to be? Thinking like 20 pages. And he goes, oh, I think 100 pages will be sufficient. All right, then. But yeah, so it was great fun. I loved doing it. But before Barry got into me, I was thinking about doing a history PhD, and I would have kept working on that. But it was 2010. I was reading Barry. I was looking at job placement rates for history PhDs and kind of got spooked. And then as it happens, if I had done the PhD, I probably would have been coming on the job market just in time for COVID. So I'm glad I didn't go that route, but I did enjoy the study.
That's fascinating.
Maybe a future book idea. We've all got to read a little more Nkrumah, I guess.
Well, thank you so much, Jake. I feel like I've valued a lot of the works that you've put out there. Harkening back to the things are more caught than taught. Even just reading your reflections on roots encourages me as I seek to put down little roots in my life, in my neighborhood. And it's an encouragement because you mentioned the throwaway culture when you feel like you live in a neighborhood that people think is like a throwaway neighborhood, and to be like, no, this is mine and I'm gonna love it. So thank you for loving your place, and I hope listeners, you are inspired to lean into all the little places that the Lord has put you in, and building community in those spaces.
Thanks for having me.
yeah so long. Hey listeners, I want to let you know about the Communion and Shalom Patreon. Joining the Patreon community not only supports this podcast, but gives you the opportunity to listen to bonus content, give input on future episodes, and submit questions for a patron-only Q&A. We're so thankful for the support and encouragement from so many listeners, and we hope that this podcast continues to be meaningful to you.